Hi.
Hi. No, I almost gave a bit of Taylor rendition there. Sadly, everyone missed it.
I think people on the live might have seen a little bit of it
Oh, you're
on
welcome.
the Facebook live. Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's why you have to be part of the EIQ community to see the real life Taylor
If
rendition.
like the incredible nutrition information wasn't enough, that's going to sway it for you, isn't it?
I think so. It's where we share all our darkest secrets, and my singing voice is one of my darkest secrets.
It's a real treat. Do you have anything to share today?
I don't think that I do. I've kind of had one of those spells where you're kind of being reactive for a couple of days, which I enjoy. But also, I haven't been proactive in things in the last couple of days, I don't think. What about you?
I got really into this book called Look Again, but then I've got halfway through it and the second half really isn't as good. They should have stopped it halfway.
It's always disappointing when that happens, but I think the real skill is being able to be like, okay, I've got everything I need from this book, I'm going to put it
But
down.
then I think sometimes the term is like, oh, am I going to miss anything? You know, you've got FOMO
Everything.
for the rest of the book, but it's not, it's, yeah. Anyway, it's a very good book, but I think, the first half is better.
Well, what's your key takeaway?
Do you know what? I've had a complete mind blank and I actually can't think of really anything. I think it's really about like how you become habituated to things.
You said this last week
Yeah,
about
and the point is
this.
like you should really look at things. But now they're talking more about, not that I don't care about this, but more like political things. And I'm like, huh, yeah.
Well,
In a way, quite scary, like that you like people just kind of stop noticing things and yeah.
I wonder if there's an evolutionary advantage to that,
Yeah, no,
like
there is. I think
right.
like habituation generally allows you to be more aware of new things. So like you might notice, like I don't know, if there's always like a humming sound. Or one of the good examples they gave actually is that people that live near like a railway, after a while, they're just like, oh, no, it doesn't really bother me, like the train going past. Whereas if you've got a friend that comes to stay, they're like, how on earth do you sleep with the train going past all the time? They're like, oh, I don't even notice it anymore. But the reason that that's an evolutionary advantage is because if there's always like background noise, you become used to it. And then if there's a new noise, you're like, oh, that's a threat. That's something new. So you should be accustomed to things that are always there. But more sensitive to new things, but obviously that can work in a negative way as well.
I can imagine. Interesting. Okay, well, shall we just get started on the questions?
I think we shall, yes.
I think we shall. Okay. Just give me a mo because they were loaded, but of course, they disappeared. Because that's what they do. Okay.
Okay.
Okay. Anna's question. And I'm going to just do the second question because she realized that the first question was covered in a
All
quick
right.
hint. Okay. One of my new clients has said she was diagnosed as allergic to MSG. She said she feels shaky and sweating once she eats food with added MSG. But she also commented that she just allows herself to have a takeaway or processed food maybe once a month. I'm trying to understand if this allergy is a way to cut off food groups. I asked how she was diagnosed, and she said that the doctor asked her to eat Chinese food and notice how she felt after. She had the symptoms after eating, and the doctor said it was related to GMS. Yeah, I'm assuming MSG. I would love to hear from you if you have experience with clients in similar situations, or if you have any recommendations on where I could find more information about it, please. You ever had this?
No, I'm just Googling it. Chinese restaurant syndrome. So, yeah. Although because it's not to do with your immune system, it cannot be called a true allergy.
Yeah, it would be like an intolerance. I think this is the point, right? Of like, it's not a diagnosis, she's not got a diagnosed allergy. The doctors, what's probably happened, although you don't know because you don't know the quality of a doctor's nutrition advice, right? Is that she's kept some, I would just hope that she's kept some sort of food diary. And this is what I would recommend in general, is keeping a food diary over the course of a couple of weeks, a month. And her diet the same, and notice when things, if things change. The problem being is that now she believes it's MSG, which it may well be. Even placebo effect is going to increase probably her feelings of those symptoms after having foods that are high in MSG. MSG's added to a lot of foods though. If it was an allergy, she would struggle. Probably it's not just like takeaway food that MSG is in. So she would probably be feeling it outside of just these times. If I think if it were me, I initially I probably, it depends on the context of the person. Like if there are a lot of rigid food rules there already, then it would be a bit more of a red flag that I would get curious about. But if it's in the context of someone saying, you know, I don't like to eat a lot of takeaways because they make me feel crap, then I think that that's okay. Like, it's not like she's saying, I never have them. She's saying, I wait until I really want one and then I have one because they don't make me feel amazing. And that, and again, it's like, what is the intent behind it? Is it, and it sounds to me, and obviously not everyone is super honest straight away, and this might come out over time when you have, like, you deepen your relationship, but it sounds to me like she's saying, my intent is to not feel shit. And I feel like it does seem to be related to foods that are higher in MSG, so I'm mindful of consuming those foods. But I would bring your attention to potentially sort of say, not necessarily list the foods, but just sort of say, you know, MSG is not just in this one type of food that you're eating. So it's interesting if you're not noticing in other things, maybe it was a coincidence at that time. I'm not saying that you have to start eating it, but maybe it was just a coincidence that that occurred at that time. Maybe it wasn't, we don't know.
Yeah, I don't think I have a lot to add. I think it doesn't sound like she's like scared of eating takeaways, although I do think that from just her own experience, it'd probably be good to, in the right way, like Amelia's just said, like ease the kind of like her thought that it might be an allergy, because then she probably will respond worse if she thinks, you know, if you have something you're like, I know this is going to make me feel shit. It's going to make you feel shit. Whereas if you're like, I don't know, I mean, it's not like I'd be like, yes, try and eat more MSG foods, but you don't want to be scared of foods and you don't want to have to like avoid them in social situations. And knowing that having a bit of it isn't the end of the world might help with that.
Agree.
I think the other thing that can often happen, I don't know if it's happening with this client, is that it. A lot of the time people will then overeat those foods and be like, see, you know, like if someone's like just absolutely like never has anything and then just like rams a massive Chinese because they're like, well, I'm only going to have this once and then I'm not going to have it again for ages. And then they end up eating like loads of it. Then the likelihood is they will feel really shit afterwards. And this, you know, this is so common with things like avoiding carbs and then being like, every time I eat carbs, I feel so bad. And it's like, yeah, because every time you eat carbs, you've avoided them for so long that you eat like a kilo of pasta. Anyone would feel like shit after that, right? So just, I guess, like make sure that she's able to enjoy a bit of Chinese or whatever it is that she wants, but not that not turn into like massive overindulgence.
Three. Okay, Becky's question. Hello, lovely, lovely ladies and two lovelies, and congratulations. Thank you so much. I have a client who is losing weight to start fertility treatments. I obviously encourage all my clients to not fixate on the scales, but she wants to get to a weight target by a specific date later on in the year and has the goal of losing 2 stone before she's able to start the treatment. It's a long enough time for her to be doing this with me in a healthy, sustainable way, but how can I support her mindset during this time and give her realistic expectations whilst also supporting her goals? I told her regardless to put the scales away as she was getting upset and frustrated that weight loss wasn't happening quickly enough, and we will step on them monthly and use other measures of fat loss. But is there anything else I should or could be doing for her or similar clients in this situation? I think we've kind of touched on this before, right? Because at least with the people that we work with, that we work with a lot of people who are trying to lose weight for fertility treatments and are often in like the obese BMI range, and so often will struggle with things like binge eating and emotional eating. And there are times where we're not 100%, we don't do things 100% the way that we would normally do things, because we're aware that this IVF cycle that they've just spent 15 grand on has to start on this day, and it's quite finely tuned to that day, and that is a priority. And it involves, and I'm sure that you'll have to have these conversations at some point, like a bit of a frank discussion of, you know, in an ideal situation, these are the things that we would do. What we're going to have to do now is possibly like condense more holistic stuff a little bit. But in order for us to you to continue to see fat loss and not rebound at the end of this, you need to can you commit to, I don't know, one of these things, like really intentionally and really focus on one of these things, and this is the reason why. I think it's tough. I think as long as, because you're weighing once a month, okay, which is great, but remember that weight is actually really important for this process. It sounds like she's got time. What I would be mindful of when you're trying to, what you're doing is just being like the most compassionate, helpful coach here. By doing that, you just need to be really mindful that she does reach that. Like there is a bit of pressure here that she does reach that goal weight, more so than people that are just have a goal weight, which whatever, that's their prerogative. So some, you know, sometimes when we're talking about weighing, you know, you often will say, Emma, like maybe weigh every day and remove the emotional attachment. And actually, maybe in this situation, that might be a better approach, so that you're still aware of it and not kind of just pretending it doesn't exist. Because what happens if you weigh in a month and it's not where she wants it to be, and then she's got even less time to get there? The potential emotional response to that, I feel like, I don't know, you know the person better than me, but I feel like it might be heightened than if you just kind of got went, okay, exposure therapy from the get-go and did this. And I think that's one thing to be mindful of. And yeah, then it's just about putting it.
I really wouldn't weigh once a month. Like, in, and if you are going to do that, at least weigh like 3 or 4 days in a row. Because it's so, I mean, like any personal trainer, I mean, most people hopefully know how much weight fluctuates. Even if she lost 2 kilograms in a month, which would be great, or 4 pounds, whatever, that could easily be accounted for by a weight fluctuation. Or at least a lot of it could be. And then she's like, oh my God, I put all this effort in. I've only lost a pound in a month. And then it's like the worst motivation ever. If, and then she ends up overeating and then she does put on the weight again, you know, like, or whatever. I think the weight part of it is hard because, like, it's there's so much psychology involved in that. And I would really, really like, depending on who it was and how closely I was working with them, I'd even get them to like weigh while they're on the phone to me. So they're not like, yeah, I weighed myself. I didn't tell you till the next day. And then I ended up a massively overeating. And then blah, blah, blah. And before you know it, they kind of have undone quite a lot of their hard work. So that kind of, if they've got a really poor relationship with the scales, like you do really want to think about that. The other thing is that, you know, there's actually quite a lot of research. This is more so in, I don't know if I've ever seen it actually. Now I'm kind of surprised why there isn't this, but things like the Newcastle diet for type 2 diabetes, where they lose weight very quickly in a very short period of time with a diet that is completely not sustainable. It's not meant to be sustainable. It's about 600 to 800 calories a day. Most of it comes from like a kind of soup thing and like meal replacement shape and a shake and then some vegetables, right? That's it. That's what they eat for 8 weeks. They lose a lot of weight very quickly. I don't know why that's not given out by the NHS for like, maybe it is.
I think it's more to do with like the post. So that's to get start the treatment, right? Then you've got a month where you're getting injected a lot, and then you've got the implantation, and then your movement's going to be off, and then you could be pregnant. And I would imagine it's to do with like what happens at the end of that. They've hit it, they've started their treatment. Do they then start injecting and go through that emotional turmoil that is emotional turmoil, and then regain the weight whilst they're going through that process, then get pregnant, and then be potentially in an, another situation? So
No,
I would,
I can see logically why
but
they would.
yeah, okay,
Why,
yeah.
like, the NHS with it.
True.
You know what I mean? If it's just like
Yeah.
this box, because a lot of the time with IVF treatment, from like my experience with clients, it's like, okay, you need to lose this weight. Bye.
Yeah.
Not like, here's all this help. Like I would expect, like, if they really wanted that to happen, they would kind of give
Yeah,
some kind
you're
of signal.
right. I wonder if there's a reason why they don't. I
I
just.
mean, I wouldn't be against, maybe not to that extreme, but like lower calories than what I would normally put someone on, especially if there's an endpoint in mind and there's a specific reason for it and motivation is high. And there are, like, when you look into the research around those diets, like the success rate is surprisingly high. And I think it's partly because moderation is really hard, right? Like saying no to a biscuit is actually quite easy. Eating half a biscuit is hard. Right. And when you like extrapolate that out, like if you're on this diet, you can't eat out. You can't, like have a bit of this with your friend or a bit of this here or eat more calories this day and less that day. It's so different that in some ways it makes it kind of easier to stick to for a finite period of time. Even the research like on follow-up shows that, yeah, people regain some weight, they still lose a significant amount of weight and keep it off. So I don't know, like it might be an approach. Again, I'd go to that extreme. I'd probably modify it somewhat, but I wouldn't be against putting some people in some situations in a significantly bigger deficit with the right support.
I think that, yeah, I think you're right. And it depends on their relationship with food. Someone actually emailed me last week with a picture of her baby who we did that, and she only had, I think, 2 months before her next round of IVF, and she got through it. It wasn't successful at the time, and then she kept touch base, and she maintained a relationship for food for the entire time, went through another cycle, got pregnant, and sent me the baby the other day. And she was someone who worked with me and so struggled with some of the disordered eating habits. And so, yeah, it does depend on where they're at.
The other thing that's quite interesting is the research around hunger on very low calorie diets and how it's actually reduced, which is so like counterintuitive of like, oh well, if you're on low calories, you'll definitely have higher hunger, but actually not what it shows.
It's interesting. Okay. Becky's question. Another last. I'm sorry, it was a last minute quizzy last week, Becky, but it's a well-informed question this week. So for context, I work as an ODP in theatres as well as an online coach. We're doing a gastric sleeve for a patient, and I've just heard my very experienced and knowledgeable surgeon say that when someone reaches a BMI of over 40, they may be able to lose a stone by starving themselves, lol, but then they would struggle to lose any more without intervention because of hormone levels in the body. What could he be referring to, and what evidence is there of this?
He's wrong.
It's so interesting because you've said he's very experienced and knowledgeable surgeon. He is a very knowledgeable and experienced surgeon, but
Not weight loss expert.
Yeah. Yeah, no.
And
He'll
if anything, almost the opposite would happen. It's like your hormones, if you've lost a stone, I mean, if you're that obese, the stone's probably not really going to make the biggest amount of difference, even though that is quite a lot of weight. But you would be more sensitive to like hunger regulation. Your hormones would be improving, not getting worse.
Yeah, he's referring to like starvation mode, isn't he? Of like that's I assume that's what he's
Yeah,
like.
I guess.
I guess that's what he's talking about, which isn't a thing, but it's what people who are uninformed or people who are anti-diet share.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be amazing if an obese person was in starvation mode and somehow was like storing this like huge, huge body mass with what, like no basal metabolic rate at
Yeah,
all,
just
or
stop expending energy.
you could send him the study of the man who didn't eat for a year.
Or the Minnesota starvation experiment.
Yeah.
They like that one because it's an old one, 50s.
Oh, this is old as well.
Is it?
Yeah. And he
Oh.
was from Dundee. It's so weird. Yeah,
Know
the
what?
he just decided not going to eat for a year. And like, I think he got injected with vitamins a couple of times.
Did
No.
Huberman tell him to
Maybe. I mean, it was before the times of Huberman.
Maybe it was the OG.
You know what the weirdest thing, when you read the case study on it, he still does poos now and again.
Well, whilst he's not eating.
Yeah. I never really understood why. Like, what? Do you know what I mean? Like, what is it?
Where is it?
I don't
What
know.
is it? Is it like,
I don't know. I mean, didn't know like
oh,
what the substance of, what kind of poo it
what
was
consistency it wasn't.
on the
Crystal still Jack.
but it is a bit like how?
Interesting. I actually didn't go and delve into that one further.
I
Anyway,
know.
let us know. Okay, Lucy's question. Hi, lovelies. I just wondered if you had any thoughts on a client who says she gets cold after eating her meals. I've asked her to mention this to the GP, but I wondered if you had any thoughts on this. She has had a tricky relationship with food, however, has been doing really well with eating regularly and eating nutrient-dense foods. This hasn't always been the case. So my first thought on this is that she's just stopped moving and sat down and it's cold. I know that sound, usually it's like when you hear hooves, it's usually a horse, not a zebra. Like I feel a little bit like I get cold when I eat sometimes because my heating doesn't come on till 4 p.m. and it's lunchtime and it's cold. Like, so my, and especially if, she, and this is really judgmental, not really judgmental, this is me, unconscious bias rather. If she's got a tricky relationship,
Conscious bias.
possibly, oh, yeah. Okay, I'll take that. That sounds better. But if she's got a tricky relationship with food and you've been working on eating more nutrient dense foods, that suggests to me that she maybe didn't eat so many nutrient dense foods. Maybe she underate potentially before. So she's maybe at a lower body weight, maybe. And often people at a lower body weight tend to move a lot more, walk a lot more, train, all of these things. But tend to feel the cold more, and then so she doesn't slow down as much, so she slows down when she eats. That would be my only suggestion, I think, because when you eat, you do have that thermic effect food.
Yeah, so I think, and you're right, because I think I've experienced both things. I've definitely experienced being cold when I've eaten, and I think it was due more to like the redistribution of blood to like digestion as opposed to your peripherals. So like and especially if you're someone who struggles with Raynaud's, then it could be that like, oh, I've got really cold hands, and it's like, yeah, because the blood's like gone to your stomach to digest food. I think there might be an element of that, but then also you're right, like the flip side happens as well, where when you eat a lot, sometimes you get really hungry, especially like meat, right? Like a lot of protein or something, and you
Yeah.
get hungry.
You mean
How
hot?
is that with protein?
Do you mean really hot, not hungry?
Sorry, hot, yeah. Yeah,
I
when
was
I
like
eat a lot of meat, it's get really
Well,
hungry.
because she said it twice, I was like, maybe she does mean that. I think it's the thermic effect. Protein's got the highest thermic
Yeah,
effect.
okay, that's true. Yeah.
I think it's that.
But I wonder why it's, I guess it's more digestive, is taking more energy to break it down. Because then I was just thinking about like I'm drinking coffee now. I was like, this is decaf, so it's not gonna have an effect. But like that would be more like vasodilation. So that's why you get like hot drinking a coffee. But that's more like blood going more peripherally. That's why some people get like a bit rosy cheeked. And then same with alcohol, but that can be quite dangerous because then your core body temperature can drop, but you
Maybe.
feel really hot. And then you're like, hey, it's fine. I'll just sit outside for hours.
It's not fine.
It's not fine. No.
Okay. Moving on. Listen to this question. Lots of supplement companies are pushing stacks at the moment, and I've got a client who has a pre-workout and a creatine that both have 3,200 milligrams of beta-alanine in. So if they take their daily creatine and a pre-workout on training days, is there any detriment to them having 6,400 milligrams of beta-alanine in their system? Or is it just the case that it won't be used and it will be unharmful? It will be very uncomfortable because you'll
I was
get
gonna say,
really
like,
get extreme paresthesia. I think you have to take a hell of a lot for it to be harmful. It's probably harmful to her bank account, and she's probably got, or he, or they have got very tingly fingers, and
well, it says here, 3.2 to 6.4 grams per day effective. So she's on the upper side of that, right?
Yeah.
And considering if it's a woman, it's probably like a smaller person.
Yeah, they've not said, they've actually said they, but so that
Okay, sorry. Well, depending on their size. So yeah, I mean, it's probably not the most ridiculous dosages. It does look like 4 to 6 grams is kind of like what's been shown to increase performance, but
just seems, it seems, yeah.
it seems unnecessary for
Agreed.
sure.
And it unnecessary and tingly. It actually makes me feel a little bit antsy even just thinking about what that feels like in your body.
I also think most people aren't, so that dosage is for improved endurance performance. I don't think most people are taking beta-alanine for that reason. If they are, fine, maybe they do want to dose on that much. I think most people almost take it for a bit of a placebo, to be honest. Like they want to feel like I've had a pre-workout, I can feel something, as opposed to I've had a pre-workout, I wouldn't know if I've had it or not. You know, like creatine, you don't feel any different after you take it. But when you take caffeine, you can feel it. Or when you take beta-alanine, you can feel it. So it feels like it's doing something. I think that's probably the primary reason they put it in pre-workouts, hence why it's slightly underdosed in a lot of them. And I did, yeah, like I say, I don't think most people are taking it for endurance purposes. So like the endurance performance benefit that you're going to see is it's going to buffer lactate. If you're someone who's not performing at a level that they're going to be creating a load of lactate buildup, then I don't really see what, like, why you would be taking it.
Read. Got a little bit distracted there because Melly's asked the next question. And she has a lovely profile picture. And I have a picture, it doesn't look as lovely as yours, Millie, but I have a picture and it looks very similar. And I clicked on the page and it looks exactly the same as my best friend's garden where I took a picture. And now I'm like, oh, I wonder where you live. Millie, where do you live? Tell me. Would love to know. I wonder if it's down the road from my best friend because it looks very similar.
Oh.
Anyway, I got distracted. Sorry. Okay. Hi, my loves. Protein pairing question here. I have a client that gets very bogged down with the numbers. She hits her 100 grams plus of protein every day as a vegan. I pulled her away from tracking for 4 months as she was getting a little bit OTT and we weren't dieting, so not needed. And she's felt so much better for not tracking. We're now in a deficit for the next 8 weeks. I'm reluctant to show her the protein pairing as I think she will look too much into it. Her MyFitnessPal shows good protein pairing. What are your thoughts on this regarding relationship with food? Yeah. No, we didn't approach it. It's
No.
really not necessary, would you?
No, sorry, I was just she lives in Stockton.
Don't think that's the same place. Is that near Warrington?
No idea.
Sorry.
I wouldn't bother. She's getting over 100 grams as a vegan. If you know that she's the kind of person that's going to be like, oh my God, now I need to only eat this protein with this sauce, and like it's kind of going to undo a lot of work. I also just don't think it would make that much difference.
Yeah.
So it's not worth her brain power.
Agreed. Agreed. Okay, Catherine, what to say to people who say they don't like any fruit and veg at all?
Surely.
I was waiting for this because I love when you guys this
Oh,
question.
what? That's what I'm saying. Come on. Like, I'm sorry. Who doesn't like any fruit and veg?
Do you know what I was eating just like whole yesterday? Just basic tomatoes. Because I was making my Greek salad, wasn't I? And I
Oh.
was having it a little bit later and I was just a big juicy tomato. It's been a while. Just delicious. Delicious.
Oh.
Oh,
Yeah, do
anyway.
you know what? Yeah, that you're probably just not looking for the right fruit and veg.
Correct. If this is somebody that I was working with, I would say I understand that like you don't love them. I wonder if there's anything that you've never tried before. I'd love this week for you to
I
go and try.
wonder if there's anything that you've never tried. Oh.
I would like you this week to go into the supermarket and pick something that looks most appealing to you, whether you've had it before or not, and introduce it just one thing. And honestly, so. It depends on the relationships you have with the person. It depends on who the person is. Some people you really will have to start from let's have an apple after lunch every day, and that's it. And but for other people, they might be the types of people that respond a little bit better to you saying, like, okay, for your health, like, you need to be having these things, and being a bit harder with them. But you can't just say, okay, let's just not have them.
Or even like, okay, well, can you have soup? Or can you have a smoothie? Or, there's, have you had Mediterranean roast veg with like properly seasoned? I just can't believe that people don't like that stuff.
I don't love Mediterranean roasted veg, I have to say.
It's
Most
so good. And when it's cooking, it smells like there's pizza in the oven.
it's the oregano, isn't it?
You'd be quite upset because then you'd get it out and
Yeah. Yeah.
it's not pizza.
It's aubergine and courgette. Well,
Oh, good old courgette.
what?
Yeah, I'm sure they can find some.
You just can't not do anything about it. Like, you're focused, like, your priority is their health, and so that's why you're pushing it, and expressing that too, of like, you've hired me to support you in your health journey. It would be unethical of me to just say, okay, let's just eat non-fruit and veg.
Yesterday I just had a flashback to this. I'm not really sure why I did this now that I'm thinking back, but well, I do. I'd run out of frozen peas, right? And you know how I feel about peas at the moment. Like, so what did I do? I got a can of peas.
No,
Have you
no.
ever done that?
I don't think I like canned peas.
They were disgusting. Like,
Okay.
not even. Well, actually, first I had a bit, and I was, well, one, why are they not green but like yellow?
Don't
Why?
know.
What happened to the can? Like, why are they yellow? I don't understand. Anyway, kind of yellow and like a little bit mushy, but not like nice like mushy peas, because I can get behind that. Just like they're not meant to be mushy, but they are. And they just didn't. At first, I thought they didn't taste of anything, and then I was like, no, they taste really bad, real bad. Actually, this reminds me of the time I got frozen Brussels sprouts. Horrendous.
Yeah, no,
Like,
they're not the same.
so disgusting. And I
And
also, just for the crack, I got Brussels sprouts in a can once, and they were hideous.
no. Of course they were disgusting.
They're
They're
really
sitting in
mushy,
their own fart juice.
yes, literally fart juice. I remember trying to get one out with a spoon, and it was like, it just
No.
broke up because it was just so, there was nothing holding it together. It was gross.
I got carrots in a tin once and they were disgusting. My mum was like, why would you ever do that? And I was like, I thought they would taste like carrots.
No,
No.
so, yeah, same thing happens with
And
carrots. It
they
doesn't
don't
taste of
taste like.
anything apart from just like squidge that's kind of been in like fart juice.
I feel quite sick, so let's move on. Okay,
We're
so
also
don't
agreeing
recommend them.
that canned peas don't sound right and that frozen Brussels sprouts are horrendous. Yeah.
Correct. Okay. Lena's question. Hello, lovelies. Menopause question. What to say to someone who was told by her doctor that, quote unquote, as perimenopause commences and throughout, estrogen loves fat cells, and because menopause results in reduced estrogen, it tries to hold on by holding your fat cells hostage, hence difficult to shift despite ramping up the exercise, close quotes. The doctor then went on to say that, quote, the weight will fall off once it's all over. I understand that it's harder to lose weight, but not due to fat cells being held hostage. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this one. And Annie said, I had almost an identical conversation this week with a client after her doctor said this. Go for
What a
it.
strange story to tell. Do you know what I just find interesting about things like this is, like, where do they come up with that? And sometimes I like read a, I still remember reading this diet, and it was like, you can have as much veg as you want, but not peas. You just think like, where's like the logic behind any of that? Like, surely any, like, this is an educated doctor. Surely anyone would. This is why I find it surprising, like, if you go back to the question about like a surgeon as well. It's like, what? So you really think that if someone is in a deficit, they are, where's the energy coming from if they can't lose fat, but they're eating less? Like, what do you actually think is happening? But they've obviously not kind of like thought that through. Maybe someone else has told them that years ago and they've just regurgitated it for years and years and years and never thought to question it. And this was the other actually interesting thing that came up in that book, Look Again. When something is repeated, you're much more likely to think it's true, even if it's not true, even if someone is debunking that information, right? So then I was thinking, oh God, like maybe I add to a lot of this stuff. Because even if we always talk about starvation mode, because someone has just even like peripherally heard it of, oh, I saw that on Instagram, or I saw someone talking about it, or I read it in the Daily Mail, it doesn't really matter like whether it was saying starvation mode is not a thing, or whether it was saying this is why you can't lose weight because of starvation mode. What their brain knows is they've seen it numerous times, and it's the repetition of that that makes you think that it's true. So
Interesting.
if someone's been told something again and again and again, whether it's true or not, but it's the same kind of thing, you're more likely to believe that's true.
Does that mean we're all going to start believing Eddie Abu in like 2 weeks' time when?
But there is like it becomes more like plausible because you're like, well, why would everyone talk about bulletproof coffee if there was nothing behind it? And that it does kind of make sense. You're like, well, what? Yeah, why would so many people be talking about it if there was no truth whatsoever? Surely not everybody's wrong. And it turns
Interesting.
out they are. Yeah.
They are. So the question was, oh, right, your take. Okay, that is our take.
Yeah, I mean, I think this person already knows how to explain that. Like, yeah, of course it's harder, but it's not because you have suddenly managed to store calories that you haven't consumed.
Yeah. The second part to this question. I'm going to say Emma's question. If that's not your name, I'm really sorry. I can't tell from your Empower PT. Do you know?
No.
Empower PT. I'm going to say Emma.
Emma's a strong name. Let's go with that. If it's not, you maybe could think about changing it.
Yeah, or just stick with M. Join Lem and M crew. I have a couple of clients who have recently started HRT, and they're basically expecting to gain weight as they go through menopause. Perimenopause, they have both in fact gained weight, but I suspect that this is more due to being lapsed with diet, exercise, and general habits rather than directly related to the HRT. My question is, physiologically, will the change in hormones make you gain weight, or is this more that it affects mood and motivation, and this is ultimately what causes weight gain?
I think you need to distinguish a little bit between weight and fat. So there might be, with fluctuating hormones, yes, like we all know as women that that can change how much water you're retaining. So like I have had clients who have seemed to like retain water more than anything else when they go on HRT. Now, obviously that doesn't just keep going up and up and up, be for a finite period of time or it would fluctuate. And if you're losing fat, then your weight will still trend down over time. So yeah, like that would be the only consideration. Otherwise, you're exactly right. Like it's the behaviors as opposed to HRT. Like even if you just take this, like strip it right back, is HRT gonna make you store fat that you store calories that you haven't consumed or stop you losing fat in a deficit? No, nothing's gonna do that, but might it impact your behaviors? Yes. For a lot of people, it impacts their behaviors in a positive way, Like it's actually they've got way less symptoms and it's they're sleeping better, so it's much easier to make better food choices. Maybe their hunger goes down because they're actually sleeping at night. And so most of the time it's more of a positive than a negative. So I'd maybe frame it as that, because even if their expectation is, oh, I've gone on HRT, I'm definitely going to put on weight, then their behaviors kind of sway towards that. Whereas if they think, oh, hey, this might help me with my symptoms, which might make it easier for me to stick to my diet, I would go with that.
Three. I'm really sorry for yawning in your face three times.
It's
It's not after about 5 p.m. it just becomes kind of consistent.
okay. To be fair, I just yawned as well. It might have been like a residual reciprocation of the yawn.
Like they are infectious, right? Should we do one more? Are we done?
Let's do one more.
Let's do one more. Okay. Annie's question. I'm wondering, is there any physiological rationale or evidence for hormones and cravings, or more of a behavioural emotional occurrence around these hormonal times and potential hunger influence? I'm going to say I'm going to say yes in the sense of, but it is still sort of tied into what you think it is. There is a physiological relevance to it, but it is tied more into like the mood side of things in that if you think about like the dopamine response you get to foods that are high, for example, in sugar, fat, salt, and then you think about, I'm assuming you mean like hormonal around like reproductive hormones, and we'll take like menstrual cycle as an example. If you're going through like the luteal phase where you're more likely to have low mood, you're more likely to reach like or crave foods that potentially would create more of a dopamine hit for you. And so your craving may well be towards foods that are high in salt, sugar, and fat. Some people say that slight shift in fuel utilization changes cravings, but there's no evidence for that. Like, because you're in the luteal phase, you become slightly less insulin sensitive. People suggest that that's maybe why you like have like your preference for foods change, but there I've never seen any evidence to say that that's what happened.
Don't you think that's so interesting as well, though, that nobody questions that? They will just hear someone say it, and then they'll hear someone else say it, and then they'll just be like, oh yeah, seems to, like, makes sense, seems true, and then they just believe it. And same with, like, one of the most common ones I see is, like, you feel stressed, thus your cortisol must be high, thus X, you know, or you should take this supplement, or something's definitely happening, or that's why you're craving this, or something. It's like there's absolutely, you know, it might make plausible potential sense, but there's no evidence for it. I would be very surprised and actually quite impressed if the slight change in insulin sensitivity, you would have the ability to feel that to an extent that it would change your cravings around sugar. Like, that would be quite, like, you'd be so in tune with your body. And I know people like, but I mean, like, to me, that would, like, I just think that definitely wouldn't be happening. But what people will experience is, maybe they feel like more hormonal or something. They're looking for comfort, and then they crave sugar, right? But most people are likely, they probably want to believe more that, oh, there's this physiological reason that this is happening, and, like, there is. But people kind of prefer to think, oh, it must be that slight shift in insulin sensitivity that's causing me to want more sugar, as opposed to it's actually impacted my mood. I feel quite emotional, and I want something that's comforting. And for most people, that's something that's high in fat, high in sugar.
What I think is interesting, and I was doing some research on this actually last week, is the relationship between like reproductive hormones and like disordered eating and binge eating and stuff. And like anecdotally, most of us know that if we're prone to emotionally eat, we're more likely to emotionally eat during the luteal phase, and we see that like in research as well as like ourselves, right? But the reason I was looking at it was in pregnancy for a lot of people, some people their disordered eating gets worse. Some people it gets better. What they tend to see is people who are still in kind of the struggles of disordered eating, they tend to see like a slight remission, but people who have maybe recovered maybe see more of a relapse, or not a relapse but like a lapse during theirs.
Wait,
But
say that again. Oh, so
people
if they're already struggling with disordered eating and they get pregnant, they're more likely to have improved relationship with food.
Yeah, they're more likely to see slight remission of their symptoms. But if people have maybe, say someone, like if we take eating disorders as a more extreme example of this, and they've recovered, then they may see a remission during pregnancy. But if they're maybe struggling with it and they fall pregnant, they're more likely potentially to see remission. I've got that in mind. Yeah.
Do you think
Which is
that's
interesting.
partly just because they have, like, a, I don't know, say you were bulimic or something, and then you got pregnant, it's like, I really can't do this anymore.
I think it is that, but I think with bulimia, it's less, it's not cognitive, is it, right? So I think even though you know that you're not supposed to, or it's not healthy, that's never really, you've always known it's not healthy, right? So, but I do think there's definitely an element, there's lots of different things in terms of like body image and like caring for someone else, and it's not about yourself. I guess it depends a lot on like the etiology of your disordered eating. But kind of what ties into this question, which is what I was thinking about, was one of the reasons they think you see a remission is that it might be associated with reproductive hormones, where when you're pregnant, estrogen and progesterone are really high. And then postpartum, when they drop like abruptly, you can see that we see like increases in disordered eating again. And then there's lots of things that change that, but they mirror that mirrors the changes you get throughout the menstrual cycle phase, where when they drop, we see highest incidence of disordered eating, like in that end of luteal phase. But when estrogen and when estrogen especially is high, we see lower rates of it. So, but they, I don't know what the mechanistic, I don't think the researchers, I don't think there's been a mechanistic reasoning as to why they're not saying that causes it, but we definitely see associations between hormones and, you know, disordered eating. And I assume with that, the types of foods that are chosen. But obviously, we're
Yeah,
women.
I wonder if a lot of it is like I say just, but like mood.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think I think that that's why they're always just like associations, right?
Yeah. All right, great chat.
Thanks for the questions. Keep them coming. We'll continue on next time. Oops, just opened us up. And I'm just going to leave a comment to know that where we are for next time.
Okay.
Okay,
Bye.
bye.